from Ottawa, Canada. You know, that other country to the north. That's the Soul Jazz Orchestra with As the Crow Flies. It's from their 2014 album, Inner Fire. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're continuing yesterday's discussion about the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Foundation and its highly irregular ways of operating. If you listened yesterday, you know that we had an extraordinary insight into this foundation and from a particularly extraordinary person. In a startling development related to yesterday's program about the Clinton Foundation, news broke yesterday, almost immediately after the program, that Governor Terry McAuliffe of Virginia, a close friend and political ally of Bill and Hillary Clinton, and a former member of the foundation's board, is the target of a joint FBI-U.S. Justice Department investigation, allegedly looking into illegal campaign contributions. The probe speaks directly to the issue that our guest, former Wall Street banker and investor Charles K. Ortel, was raising. He returns today and raises the question again. We continue with the same question from yesterday, the highly questionable fundraising practices of the Clinton Foundation. Mr. Ortel blew the whistle on General Electric in 2007-2008, after his own investigation of the financial records of the conglomerate revealed that it had fraudulently overvalued its stock. Ortel says his own examination of the Clinton Foundation's financial records leads him to believe it is engaging in massive fraud under the guise of philanthropy. And I welcome you back today. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Well, I'm sure that the news yesterday of Terry McAuliffe's supposedly being in the crosshairs of the Justice Department and the FBI kind of jangled your nerves a little bit. What was your reaction?
Well, it's not surprising to me. I think we even were talking a little bit about it yesterday. If you look into the disclosures of the Clinton Foundation closely, as I've been doing, actually, the IRS and the state governments and the foreign governments that regulate this entity ask the very tough questions that you're supposed to answer truthfully and completely in the various forms. And because the Clinton Foundation is a public charity, that is to say, it's continuously raising money from the public, even while we're on this phone call, any member of the public has a right to see these forms. And indeed, I would suggest if you're going to make a significant donation, you should look at these forms closely. And what they've been trying to do, in my opinion, is to mask the fact that the Clinton Foundation was established way back in inception, October 23rd, 1997, precisely because the Clintons were under great financial distress as a mechanism to raise money illegally. And I can take you through how I reached that conclusion if you're interested.
Absolutely. Let's go.
All right. Well, so if you turn your mind back, and I'm going to stay away from the sort of infidelity aspects of the Clinton spectacle. I'll stay away from Whitewater, and I'll just dwell on campaign finance issues. In 1996, serious questions were raised, as of course, the other side, the Republicans, would raise about a sitting president, as to whether or not Bill Clinton and the Democrat National Committee were illegally using the various elective offices to raise funds. There were various inquiries into this. In 1997, also Bill's and Hillary's legal troubles started to get extremely severe. Remember, these people had no money to speak of when they entered the White House, and they had legal bills that were up in the, maybe even approaching $10 billion in after-tax costs. And the law firms claimed at the time that they could cut Bill a break, and Hillary a break, giving them low rates. They had to charge the top rate. So they set up an defense trust, and it emerged sometime 96, 97 that a bunch of highly questionable, potentially foreign nationals had been contributing to this trust. And that happened, I don't know the date in front of me, but sometime in 96, 97. So decisions were taken to wind the existing one down and create a new one. The person they put in charge of the new one is a man called David Pryor. He's a former senator, close ally of the Clintons. And the people they put in charge of the Clinton Foundation that was established October 23, 1997, Pryor was one of two major outside directors, the other being the president, Skip Rutherford. All of these are political associates. It is illegal to use a foundation, the fundraising efforts of a foundation, for any partisan political activity, especially for fundraising. So the forms in 1998 that are filed on the Clinton Foundation website, in my opinion, purposely obscure who the trustees were in 1998 of the foundation. But by diligent effort, people who worked with me were able to come and find forms that were filed at state level, not at federal level, that show conclusively that the man who was chairman of the second expense trust, Mr. Pryor, was also an outside director in 1998. Now, during this period, I don't know how well your listeners remember 97, 98, this was a period where, you know, the Lewinsky scandal came into full-blown light, where the impeachment process began, and on the disclosures for the foundation with a straight face, foundation claims in 98 that they only raised money from three donors, which is just simply not credible. In 99, they file forms again that show that no money came in, and again, I don't have my notes in front of me, but from memory, no money came in until June 1999, which again is simply not credible. And there are all sorts of other problems with this, with the filing. In 99, Hillary Clinton began her exploratory mission to consider being a senator. Now, of course, you can't run for Senate in New York unless you own property or unless you live in New York. So Terry McAuliffe made what I would call a sweetheart arrangement that certainly should have been disclosed in the Clinton Foundation forms and never has been, wherein, in the end, the press discovered that Terry put up sufficient liquidity, whether it was cash or securities, I don't know, such that a lender was willing to lend the Clintons enough money to get a mortgage to buy the Chappaqua property. Now, remember, at that time, Bill's prospects and Hillary's prospects were uncertain. She was running for the Senate. She was not going to be, in theory, making any money as a senator, you know, sufficient to pay for a mansion in Chappaqua, let alone a second one in Washington, D.C. And this is, I think, McAuliffe became a trustee of the foundation in 2000. And he was served as a trustee all the way through to 2013. Now, I don't know, I'm not an expert on the FBI. I only know what I read, or on the Department of Justice. And what I read is that the FBI doesn't necessarily come calling and saying, you know, this is exactly what we're investigating. While they're investigating, they investigate. They could be investigating anything. I could tell you, as somebody who's been actively in the press and writing, that not only should the FBI be investigating, not only should the Department of Justice be investigating, but every serious state and foreign regulator that cares about charity fraud needs to take a look at the form that the Clinton Foundation may have filed or did not file in the various states. And when you do that, I'm just one person. I've spent only, you know, a short time, 15 months on this. I've been through many state filings, and I can tell you that the filings in the state of Georgia are false and materially misleading. I can tell you that the filings in New York State are false and materially misleading. And all you need is one materially misleading false set of forms, and you have charity solicitation fraud, because you're not allowed to raise money over the Internet, using the telephones, using the mails, when your forms are false and materially misleading. It's that simple.
I must ask you this question about whether, in your view, from the documents that you have carefully reviewed and from your own experience, again, going back to your GE days when you were able to tell this story about the overvaluing of stock based on the figures. I mean, they didn't say, well, we are overvaluing the stock, but you were able, through detective work, to determine that. What is your conclusion about the purpose, other than the stated purpose of this foundation? What is your conclusion about the purpose of this foundation?
Well, I think it's a mixture of purposes like anything else. You know, I think there are among the Clinton supporters honest people who may fervently believe in one or more of the things that Bill and Hillary may stand for politically. I will concede that. But I also think if we look back over the long sweep, and I mean to the very beginning in Arkansas all the way forward, there certainly are one heck of a lot of disreputable people who have been targeted, who have been accused, who have been convicted, who have been associated with various sites, sorts of corporate and other malfeasance. And so I think what happened here is that, you know, there are people who are quite willing to take, you know, give to a politician and take back many times what they give. It's common. It happens in the Republican Party. It happens in, you know, independents. It happens in Democratic Party. It's just natural. But so there are a lot of people out there, and I think these crooked people figured out that you know, the Clintons could be bought. And that's what the record, I think, will show. Back on the original question about Terry McAuliffe, you know, I am on the board of a foundation. I understand how these things work. If you have a good legal team advising the board, they will scare a trustee severely, because you are responsible for what happens in the foundation as a trustee. You can't slough it off on the executive account, the lawyers. It's your problem. If the foundation takes illegal money, it's your problem. If the foundation strays from its authorized purpose, it's your problem. If you give money to what you think is a charity, but it's not a charity. And it's certainly a problem if you make a decision as a group that, you know, let's say $100 million comes your way, and instead of putting that money into the foundation, you just put $2 million in, you steal $98 million. That's a big problem.
Do you, from the figures that you have looked at, with regard, say, to speech making, the Washington Post today reports that since 2001, the Clintons have earned in excess of $150 million in speaking fees. We don't know the content of these speeches, and Bernie Sanders has asked that Hillary Clinton at least release the text of her speech to Goldman Sachs. As an example, which she, of course, has declined to do. But the piece in today's Washington Post seems to be suggesting that this is not just about making speeches and getting a lot of money for it. They noted that the Clintons made in that time 62 times the average lifetime earnings of someone with a master's degree. Is there some connection from the figures that you were able to make as to income, where the money is coming from, and where it went, and what it yielded for the people paying for these speeches and the corporations paying for these speeches?
Well, I think there certainly will end up being such a connection. You know, I would guess that the issue of the missing email. My father is very much alive, and he's one of the world's experts on certain aspects of computers. And he has told me from a very, you know, years back that the E in email stands for evidence. You know, emails don't go away. You delete them on a device, they're still available somewhere. And I am going to guess at first blush that we're going to find a lot of emails that were, in fact, neither personal, but government related. You know, emails that have been deleted. I will tell you that, you know, when here's what I suspect is going on. There is an entity which really isn't an entity. It's not, as far as I know, a legal entity called Office of William J. Clinton or Office of William Jefferson Clinton. And it has an email address, owjc.org. Certain individual, Doug Band, had, and I don't know if he still has, an email address there. So as a guess, what happened is that if you want to get something out of its Clinton orbit, negotiations happen among lawyers, lawyers for the donor, lawyers for the Clinton. And, you know, a wish list is suggested, and then, you know, by what the donor wants, and a price list is suggested by the Clintons, the negotiations ensue, And through all that, there will be tremendous amounts of email traffic. You know, remember, it's not just the official emails. These are people who decided not to use the .gov email for the Secretary of State period. These are people, they have trustees. I believe there's one trustee who's the former EPA head or energy head or something who is using a fake name. These are people who might very well have alias emails. They might even have emails, in the case of Uma Abed, in a foreign language or in a foreign carrier. So, as a guess, what happens is, you know, crooked foreign company comes along and says, I want this change, I want that, I want to tell you what I'll do. I'll make, you know, this contribution to the foundation, and I'll make this speech arrangement, and I'll let the son-in-law have this sweetheart investment here and do this, and they go back and forth, and a deal is cut. The problem with all that, and the problem with the speeches that you're talking about, is that, you know, when you are approached with the right to get to give a speech, and you say, instead of paying me, pay the foundation, if you had sway over whether you were paid or whether it should go to the foundation, you're supposed to recognize that as income. And the significance of that is that if you live in New York State and other states, as the Clintons do, your ability to deduct the donation may be limited. So then there are all kinds of state, federal, and foreign tax law questions. And then going to the heart of your question, I'm a total nerd. I'll confess that I'm a total nerd. I love numbers. I love data. And there is a great government production called it's a consumer expenditure survey. It's available online. It goes into great detail by income quintile, so the top 20% down to the bottom 20%, how much people make, how much they spend, what they spend it on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you look at the top quintile, that's the top people in America, top 20% of all households. Everybody from 2008-09 forward has been worse off. But the top quintile, which consists of people who have like 2.1 earners in the household, makes around $200,000 for a whole year. So when you think about paying somebody $500,000 for a speech, and you think about the fact that the speech is unlikely to be a custom speech, it's more likely to be a stump speech repeated over and over and over again, why would anybody ever pay that amount of money to anybody? You know, I could see paying it to Beyonce, because she at least would sing, but, you know, to have a politician, you know, mumbo jumbo through a whole bunch of, you know, slogans and propaganda, it doesn't make sense. And a related question is, you know, you look through how people are paid generally for writing books. There's tons of people willing to write for nothing. So, you know, even great authors don't make $15 million advances. So why was Hillary paid so much for her book? Why was Bill paid so much for his book? And by the way, why was Laura Bush paid, and why was George W. Bush paid, and what's going on with all that?
The FBI Justice Department investigation supposedly centers on a period when Terry McAuliffe was, in fact, a member of the board of directors of the Clinton Foundation. Does that ring any bells for you?
Sure. You see, he was on the board. Of the people who were on the board from 2000 to 2012, if you look at what are called the Form 990s, those are the official federal tax forms that must list out who the trustees were of the Master Foundation. Terry McAuliffe is listed as a trustee, I believe, from 2000 right the way through to, you know, about the day that he resigned to become governor, which I think was in 2013. Okay? In that period, 2000 to 2012, there were very few people serving on the actual board as far as the, you know, disclosure goes to the IRS. Now, they may have had an advisory board, but generally speaking, an advisory board has no legal standing. It's just, you know, for show. The one that counts is the one that's on the federal tax form. Of the people listed in that form, Terry McAuliffe was what we would call in the corporate world the lead trustee. That's not a formal title, but he was the one with the most experience, the most money, and the one, you know, who should have known better. In addition, I should point out and remind your audience, he was chairman of the Democratic National Party in 2004, and he held influential fundraising roles both for the Hillary senatorial campaign, her re-election campaign, her presidential in her presidential campaign. So the FBI could well be looking, as it should be, into filings for the various campaigns to see whether activities of the campaign were commingled with activities of the foundation. So you look at the long history of the Clintons, and you find gullible young people who are given great positions of responsibility in Hillary's initial fundraising campaign for her Senate, and then later for her presidential campaign. There's a guy called Dennis Cheng, who is a Hong Kong-educated guy. I don't know his nationality, who was very active raising money, I think, for Hillary's re-election campaign in 2006. And then he became deputy chief of protocol at the State Department, which is an extremely important post. The head of protocol is the person who sort of, you know, goes to the parties. The deputy chief is the one who, you know, really thinks through what foreigners ought to be allowed to come here with what foreign dignitaries, et cetera. And the contact information that that person would get in the role of deputy chief of protocol is portable. And nothing is to stop Dennis Cheng from taking the personal email address of the leader of China with him one night back home. And that kind of information can be enormously valuable. So guess who becomes put in charge after a number of years of raising money for a $250 million endowment of the foundation? One Dennis Cheng. So as a guess, you know, what the FBI would be doing here if this were the Leeds Foundation or the Ortel Foundation or, you know, any other Smith Foundation, with this kind of amount of red flag, they would be saying to the trustees, all right, we demand to see the books and records of this foundation from formation forward. We want to see every single meeting. We want to see the minutes, what was discussed. And they put together a timeline. And when they did that, they would discover the kinds of things that are listed out in my 40 exhibits on my site. And they would conclude that this has been a fraud since inception.
Why would you, what would you say is, might be the reason that we haven't heard a congressional response yet for anybody wanting to look deeper into this, even just to answer the question, where was the IRS and any other federal oversight body while all of these things were going on with the Clinton Foundation, including raising questions about its stated purpose and looking at what actually was serving as the purpose of this foundation?
Well, I actually think there's a hearing, I think, going on as we speak, where the chairman of the IRS has refused to show up to an inquiry into, you know, what was really going on over the Lois Lerner matter. You know, one reason that this is so radioactive or nuclear or whatever, or thermonuclear, is that the key person who was overseeing the IRS and tax-exempt organizations was one Lois Lerner from January 2001 until she left in, I think, whenever it was, sometime in 2013. She's the person who, on the one hand, appears to have looked the other way when it came to the spider web of Clinton Foundation. And here, you know, we're not just talking about the Clinton Foundation, but lots of other affiliates. There's the Center for American Progress, and John Podesta, and his brother Tony, you know, who were involved tangentially in this. So you have, it would appear to, you know, this neutral person that you had a situation in the IRS where friends of the people running this key department would get a pass on gross irregularities. I mean, this is a long-standing pattern and practice. It's what I would call, frankly, I don't want to insult your listeners by saying it's a vast left-wing conspiracy, because I don't know that it is. It's just a vast conspiracy. And on the other hand, Lois Lerner and her team made a decision, it's reported, to aggressively go after and enforce rules and regulations against supposed Tea Party conservative groups. And that's not right. You know, I mean, we're supposed to have the scales of justice are supposed to be neutral and blind. And, you know, you should, the second you send a message out, as I think the Clintons have for decades, that, you know, if you get on my side, you'll get benefits, but if you get on opposing me, we're going to persecute you. And that's a very dangerous approach to governance that doesn't belong in the United States of America.
We're joined now by Haitian-born journalist Daddy Chéri, author of We Have Dared to Be Free, Haiti's Struggle Against Occupation. and she has written extensively on developments in Haiti and emerging nations for News Junkie Post. She is joining us to tell us about the Haiti connection and Hillary and Bill Clinton. Thanks, Daddy, for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Yatrice.
I should mention, Charles, that it was through Daddy's interview with you that I came to know you. So an interesting connection going on this program here. What is significance of Haiti? Why Haiti and the Clintons? What's this relationship? From what you have been gathering, you've been covering the Clintons in Haiti for a pretty long time now.
Well, there is the Monroe Doctrine. The notion that Haiti is part of the U.S.'s backyard. And in a way, what Clinton is doing is really not all that creative. The U.S. occupied Haiti back from 1915 to 1934. And back then, there was a General Russell from the United States who was supposed to run Haiti together with a nominal Haitian president. And I think this is the same model that Clinton is following. Okay. But now to come to Clinton specifically, I wish I could take a time machine back to the time when Clinton and Hillary discovered Haiti on a pleasure trip back in the 1970s and made sure they went someplace else because they have been a complete disaster for the country. So they supposedly loved Haiti so much when they came to visit in the 1970s that they basically decided to take it. All right, and the opportunity came in 1994 when Aristide was deposed as president of Haiti, and Clinton was asked, "Well, here, okay, we've got the president of Haiti. What do we do with him?" And Clinton actually organized to reinstate Aristide, but under his terms. And one of the things that he did that was extremely damaging to Haiti at the time was that he must have consulted with his Arkansas friends, and what they wanted was to make Haiti a market for Arkansas rice. So he forced the prime minister on Aristide, who decreased the tariff.
Oh.
Hello?
Are you there?
34. And I like to say that... did you want to say something, Charles?
No, I just... you cut out. I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay. We lost you for a minute there, Daddy.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I like to say that at the time that Aristide was brought into Haiti in a plexiglass box. And if you look at images from that time, you'll see... Whenever Aristide is speaking in public, he's surrounded by this plexiglass shield and a bunch of bodyguards. Okay, so this continued. Now we move on, and there were some changes in between, but I'll skip to 2004, because in 2004, Aristide was removed. The U.S. was still unhappy with him. He was removed. He was exiled to South Africa, and this happened on February 29, 2004. And by June, there was a United Nations Chapter 7 mission in Haiti, even though Haiti had no kind of civil war, no kind of war at all. This was completely unprecedented. And what had been done, really, was by the Clintons was an arrangement with Brazil to bring United Nations troops to occupy Haiti and pacify the country, because the Aristide supporters were very mad, and they were actually fighting. And this group of United Nations troops grew, and they just kept growing and growing. So you had Brazil first, and then it became the ABC countries, Argentina, Brazil, and Chile, and now it has expanded. Okay, it was very, very large, more than 5,000 at one point. At this point, it's now about 2,700 troops and 2,600 police occupying the country. And on top of that, they've trained 16,000 policemen. So the country is just full of armed people.
How did Haiti go through this process of political maneuvering by the Clinton, President Clinton, to when Hillary becomes Secretary of State and we have the foreign policy, aggressive foreign policy going? We have the earthquake, which now opens up the gates of international help, and we have now the merchandising of Haiti. Would that be an accurate chronology from your...
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely accurate. Okay. Clinton became UN Special Envoy in 2009. Okay. And throughout all this, the Clintons were actually making policy in Haiti, keeping the wages low, the assembly wages low. Right now, Haitians are making about 45 cents per hour in the assembly factories. One of those factories was inaugurated by Hillary Clinton in October 2012. It's called Caracol Industrial Park. And they destroyed farms. They're destroying an area that's an absolutely beautiful archaeological site. But they've been able to do that because they've got the political power and they've allied themselves with a lot of money and very, very powerful people. But the whole thing went on steroids in 2010 after the earthquake, because the earthquake happened on January 12, 2010. Okay, by the middle of March, Clinton already had Haiti's lower house vote on a commission called the IHRC, the Interim Haiti Recovery Commission. And it would be basically a group of Clinton and his powerful friends, and they would run Haiti. They would run the Haiti recovery for 18 months, and the parliament was supposed to dissolve itself. This was within less than 2 months of the earthquake, okay? And by April, the next month, they had the Senate vote on it. And the Senate vote, it took throughout all this, and this is why I like to tell stories about Haiti, I like to point out that Haitians aren't lying down throughout all this. Throughout all this, there are marches, there are resistance. People from the parliament actually just go out walking the streets and protesting, along with everybody else. I mean, everybody was protesting. Okay? So in April, when they tried to push this vote to the Senate, okay, the first vote was a no vote. They did it again. A bunch of senators didn't show up. It was no quorum. And then on April 14th, Michelle Obama made a trip. And it's not clear what happened at all in that trip. But April 15th, there was barely a quorum. There was exactly a quorum. There was a yes vote, and all the yeses were from the president's party, essentially, except with the exception of one person. Okay, and after that, for months and months and months, people were on the street protesting, saying that the president was turning the country over to a foreign occupation. So this is what Clinton has been doing, and this IHRC is just extraordinary. This is a group of 14 foreigners and 7 unelected Haitians who are supposed to take Haiti through an initial 18 months of reconstruction, after which they would basically become part of the government. They would become permanent. And obviously the idea was for any Haitian government to have to deal with this, so as to go beg them for aid.
Well, I do know that Hillary Clinton herself went down to Haiti to personally select and install Michel Martelly as the president of the country.
Yes. Yeah.
Let me ask Charles for 1 second here. In your figures, in your perusal of the figures and your study of the figures, is Haiti showing up as being particularly important in the revenue stream for the Clinton Foundation?
Well, it's a great question. There are various pieces to the answer. So the piece that Dottie is rightfully dwelling on is the massive estimated amounts of money that may have been raised in the name of the International Haiti Recovery Commission. In New York, city here, where there are a lot of rich people, and in America, where there are a lot of generous people, there are strict rules against monetizing disasters. And that arises in New York, particularly out of what happened here on September 11th, 2001, because sure enough, wouldn't you know, right after that disaster, fraudsters started setting up appeals on behalf of we victims here in Manhattan. And you know, lots of money disappeared. And some fraudsters did it in the name of very well-known organizations. I forget whether it was the Red Cross or something like that, but it was a well-known name. So the rules were tight in states, federally, et cetera. And the first question is that nobody really knows how much money may have been raised in the name of the desperately poor and displaced people, killed people, wounded people, emotionally distressed people, harmed by the earthquake, and maybe harmed by prior disasters. Nobody knows. And that is not right. You should not, we certainly, with the power of software and computers and everything else, we certainly today should be able to figure out how much money is raised for any charity, particularly when the scale is in this level of, as Moody is, 12 to 14 billion.
But so Daddy, even to this day, Daddy, we have people, Haitians, showing up in front of Bill Clinton's office in Manhattan and in front of the campaign headquarters, Brooklyn campaign headquarters of Hillary Clinton, demanding to know where between $6 and $10 billion in reconstruction money went. And people have been raising questions about the many corporations that were politically favored getting huge contracts, but we still have tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people who still have no home.
That's right. That's right. So the IHRC, so the estimated total that was given to Haiti was about $14 billion, and I like to think that if they had just packed up an airplane with $14 billion and dropped it on Haiti, it would have been used a lot better than what actually happened, because $14 billion is about $1,400. Per Haitian woman and child. It is a huge amount of money for a very poor country. Now, the IHRC is estimated to have raised $9.5 billion. After the IHRC, which was this strictly pay-to-play affair, totally on the table, you pay $100 million or you forgive $200 million of debt and you get a piece of Haiti. This is the way the whole thing was working, okay? But they do not answer to Haitians. They do not answer to the places where they actually raise the money. I have pictures of the IHRC raising money in New York. Okay? They don't answer to the United States. They don't seem to answer to New York State. There are Haitians who are taking them to court. Now, what they would like to hide behind UN immunity because Clinton was UN special envoy during that time. But this is, he had two jobs. He was UN Special Envoy, and he was IHRC. And he should be responsible. He should be responsible to the Haitian government. He should be responsible to the United States government. People need to know where all this went. There is a ritual. It's become kind of a yearly ritual. Whenever there's an earthquake anniversary, for people to pose the question, where did the money go? And being a poet, I always imagine people just digging through the rubble looking for the money. And there's just no money. Nobody can find the money. And there's still rubble there, and there's still people who are homeless. And how can they expect to get away with this?
Well, I do remember a very interesting picture, a very symbolic picture of Hillary Clinton standing at a podium. This was during a news conference, and behind her was a poster touting Haiti. She was Secretary of State at the time. Haiti open for business. And I wondered,
yeah.
Charles and Dottie, what did that come to mean?
Well, I could start. Well, I think it came to mean is they figured out all the state businesses and all the commons. For example, in Haiti, the coasts, the rivers, the mines are a commons. Okay, they don't belong to anybody. And basically what they've been doing is they have been selling it. So this is like, okay, goody, we've got this really good thing here. Contrary to what people say about Haiti being a disaster zone, Haiti has thousands of miles of virgin coasts. It's got totally virgin cloud forests. And this is what's being sold to the Clinton friends. Okay, we're gonna get all the offshore islands. We're gonna take every inch of the coast. We're gonna build villas. We're gonna sell villas to whatever rich people want to come and settle in Haiti. This is what's happening. And whenever they go, and a bunch of peasants, people who actually work the land in common protest, these people are killed. This is very, very serious.
You know? Charles, what does open for business come to mean to you from your vantage point of the numbers guy?
Well, in the first instance, you know, we touched on the Recovery Commission. There is a strict prohibition of a charity, which is what the Clinton Bush Haiti Fund and also the Bill Hillary and Chelsea Clinton Foundation are supposed to be doing. They have been operating in Haiti, actually, the main foundation in 2003, and there's another foundation they set up in Florida, William J. Clinton Foundation Corporation, which I suspect is a sham. And then there's this joint thing with George W. Bush created in 2010. Those entities are absolutely forbidden from pursuing any private gains, profits, right? So that to the extent you melded Bill Clinton and the foundation's work with the Recovery Commission, which it is disclosed in papers that happened, the extent that you were doing the deals that Dottie was talking about, you're not allowed to do that. And you actually also, any insider, and it's broadly defined, insider of the Clinton Foundation of these entities would be any member of their families, of the trustees, of the executives, significant donors, people in a position to exercise influence, up to, I think, grandparents, it might be great-grandparents, down to grandchildren or great-grandchildren, spouses, everybody would have to disclose who derived any business benefit. And by that, it's not, you know, you don't have to only disclose, as you do in politics, vague amounts. Precisely how much money did any of these people make, even if it's a dollar, by way of a, you know, let's say the gold mine, which was given to Hillary's brother, who knows nothing about gold mining. You know, why did they get this incredibly valuable concession of Haiti's gold? What was going on with this company Innovita, which was supposedly getting gonna build houses? And that's an example where you had, I believe, both the Bush family, and I think Jeb Bush was a director of Innovita, and you had Clinton connections to that. And here Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, I think this was just right after the earthquake, or it might have been before the earthquake, arranged for this Florida-based company to get money out of the U.S. government to provide housing in Haiti. And it turned out that the guy that was behind this company basically stole it and stole some of it and put a bunch of it up his nose, and he's in prison for fraud. None of that's allowed. All of that must be disclosed. And, you know, Congress is quite fond of having hearings. I think America's record in Haiti deserves a special, empowered, and I mean with prosecutorial ability and subpoena ability, commission to go in and not, you know, like a paperwork commission, to go and find out what the heck has really been going on in Haiti, and why is it that this mighty country of America, which we think rightfully we can help around the world, why has our record in Haiti been so poor? If there have been crimes committed here where monies have been stolen, let's get that money back, however we have to do it. Let's get the FBI on it, and let's pursue the people who've been sucking Haiti dry in the name of charity, trying to claim that they're, you know, politicians and do-gooders. Let's make an example of these people, because it's not right to exploit other people, and it's certainly not right to do it when the victims involved live in one of the poorest countries in the rich hemisphere of this planet. It's just outrageous.
But, Dottie, if I recall, even Chelsea Clinton was critical of the performance of the foundation with regard to the rebuilding effort and called into question whether it was being effective.
Yes, she did. And then of course they did nothing about it. That's kind of typical Clinton strategy. Now, I think a more interesting thing that happened is at one point, when the Clinton, when the IHRC came up for renewal, it was supposed to come up for renewal after 18 months, the Haitian Senate simply chose, the Haitian Senate did not dissolve itself, that's number one, and then it chose simply not to even discuss the renewal. But at one meeting of the Senate Public Works Committee, a senator actually accused the Clinton Foundation of outright fraud, because what they were doing is they were actually taking credit for some works that were actually funded by the European Union. You see? So there were some fairly blatant things going on there. When the Senate of a country meets in a committee and a senator accuses the foundation of fraud.
I go back to the point of where this whole thing started, when the Caribbean community had voted that Jamaica's former Prime Minister P.J. Patterson was to be the one to basically oversee this process. And then Bill Clinton kind of swooped in and pushed him out. But that was really the first sign for me that they were very serious about this money and protecting their interest in Haiti. As we wrap up, I would ask you, Charles, what is the smoking gun here?
Well, I'd say the first smoking gun, and it's not just because I'm a numbers guy, is that the Clinton Foundation and its many entities have never actually produced an audit that is required. So without an audit, there's no double checking of what really happened to this money. Give you an idea of what happens in a real audit. In a real audit, the management prepares financial statements and supporting schedules, and they start with the revenue, the inflows of the foundation, and they prepare a list of all of the people who gave money to the foundation, the major ones. And a good audit, the auditor will then contact each of the people on that list and ask them to sign a document that confirms how much money, it's called a confirmation, how much money the donor actually gave to the foundation. You go through that kind of exercise. If there's one standard rule of thumb in that process is if you don't get the revenues right, you think about that. You know, you can't keep track of the money coming in the front door. Chances are you're not going to get the expenses right. So when there are discrepancies between what the Clinton Foundation says it got and what the donors say they gave, that's a massive red flag. So they've never been through that exercise from the very beginning, right through the president, especially after last year when various people, including me, were making an issue of this. They never have provided a bona fide audit. And that's a gigantic problem.
And this
that's
is from,
illegal.
I mean, they began officially in 1997.
Right.
So that's right. Long time to go without an official audit.
Exactly. And unless people think, you know, back in 1997, laws weren't sophisticated, of course the Clinton Foundation approached people here in New York and in California and other places, and I can tell you that the New York law is extremely strict, and it was strict back then. So not only did they have to get an audit, not only did it have to be compliant with the various laws, but they also had to fill out special registration forms here in New York State, which have not been done properly, and reports which are not there. And, you know, I don't know what rules apply in Haiti. Maybe there are rules down there, but I can tell you that around the world where the Clintons were supposed to report, those forms aren't right either, or non-existent. So this is a complete epic disaster of the foundation. It's a criminal enterprise. By criminal, I mean it has broken numerous state, federal, and foreign laws. So I would start there as being the biggest smoking gun.
Daddy, what would you say is the biggest smoking gun from your perspective?
Well, there is nothing. Anybody can go and simply look and see that there has been no reconstruction, even though billions of dollars have been raised. And I should point out, and this should be a source of embarrassment to officials in the United States who are responsible for investigating this kind of fraud. There is actually a congressman in Brazil, in Spain. His name is Rafael Blasco. He's been put in prison for 6.5 years. For embezzlement of money involving places like Haiti and Nicaragua and laundering the money to NGOs. This is something I would eventually love to see happen with the Clinton Foundation. I want to see people being delivered to prison, getting through the gates, and having to spend their time there.
Well, thank you for being with us today, Charles K. Ortel. How can people find these documents that you've been posting?
My website, thanks for asking, is Charles Ortel, ORTEL.com, a very creative name. And everything's out there, up there.
Charles Ortel, a very creative name indeed for a website. By the way, we will be continuing this discussion. This is not the end of it. We'll be moving along with this because this is a really, really important subject. And Dadi, how do people get to read the materials that you have produced on the Clintons and related issues?
Well, of course, there is my book, We Have Dared to Be Free. It's available on Amazon. And I also publish on newsjunkiepost.com and on my own news site, which is called daddysherry.org.
And Sherry is spelled?
Daddy, D-A-D-Y, Sherry, C-H-E-R-Y.
Okay. I want to thank you both for giving us all these insights today in this continuing discussion. And I really value it all the more because I know this material comes at great sacrifice and at great risk. People don't think that you are risking things when you do this, but I know for you, Charles, I'm sure from your work, you have had your fair share of threats and whatnot related to the work you do. And Dadi, you have walked into physical harm in doing the work that you have continued to do. So I want to thank you so much for your integrity and for the work that you have done and will continue to do. And we will continue this conversation. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. Coming up next, Infectious Myth with David Crow. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what you think about the program today. A pleasure always, and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.